It's The Unbelievable Truth with your host, David Mitchell.
Hello and welcome to The Unbelievable Truth, the panel show about incredible truths and barely credible lies. I'm David Mitchell. Please welcome Tony Hawk, Zoe Lyons, Holly Walsh and Henning Vane. The rules are as follows. Each panellist will present a short lecture that should be entirely false, save for five hidden truths which their opponent should try to identify. Points are scored by truths that go unnoticed, while other panellists can win points if they spot a truth or lose points if they mistake a lie for a truth. First up is Holly Walsh. Holly was born and brought up in Guildford. Sounds middle class, but she was heavily involved in gang culture, both brownies and pony club. Holly, your subject is sugar, sweet-tasting crystalline carbohydrates that are principally used to sweeten food and drinks. Off you go, Holly. Fingers on buzzers, the rest of you.
Sugar was the very first superfood, as eating 3 tablespoons a day not only lowers your blood pressure, but it's also proved to make you 15% more attractive. Hence why Tony the Tiger is so damn sexy. It's also vital to all Western medicine and some Northwestern. For example, rubbing sugar on a spider bite will immediately stop it from hurting, at least until a passing animal gets a taste for your delicious skin. Luckily, rubbing sugar on a wound speeds up the healing process.
Tony.
I think the rubbing the sugar on the spider thing does help.
Rubbing sugar on a spider bite will immediately stop it from hurting.
I don't like the way you've responded to that.
But just clarifying, it's not true, Tony.
Oh.
Zoe.
But I do think rubbing it on a wound will help to heal it. Glaze a graze.
And the slogan's ready. You're absolutely right. A study at Wolverhampton University led by Moses Mirandu has found that granulated sugar poured directly into wounds can relieve pain and speed up healing, even when antibiotics and other treatments have failed. Mirandu grew up in Zimbabwe, where he watched his father using sugar to heal wounds when he was a child. Trials have demonstrated how sugar treatments have successfully healed wounds containing bacteria resistant to antibiotics, including a patient with a severely wounded foot that was about to be amputated and was saved by the sugar treatment.
Why don't we get told that more often?
I'll tell you again. A study... No, I know. Yeah.
Isn't there an expression like rubbing salt into a wound, making it worse?
I think salt in a wound hurts, but I don't think it's bad for the wound.
But isn't it like insult...
Well, no. It's your bloody lecture. You tell us.
They also say, talking about pouring oil on troubled water, and BP has never got the credit for that.
You'll be safe from dogs, though, as they can't taste sugar. Then neither could you if you spent that long licking your own bumhole. Other animals that can't taste sugar include cats, lizards, and Lloyd Grossman, who lost most of his taste buds in the late 90s after a Vindaloo challenge. Sugar is the active ingredient in fake tan, which is why you turn the same colour as creme brulee, and why you can save on expensive tanning treatments by dusting yourself in demerara and lying under a hot grill.
Tony.
Well, there is a lot of sugar in fake tan.
There is.
There
absolutely.
Is. Oh.
You're absolutely right. Yes, the bronzing ingredient in many self-tanning products is sugar. Dihydroxyacetone, or DHA, is one of the primary ingredients found in tanning products. It's a colourless, non-toxic sugar that's derived from plants like sugarcane and beets. When rubbed onto human skin, it triggers a protein reaction that imparts a brown colour to the skin.
Before the introduction of sugar to Europe, people had to sprinkle desiccated beetroot on their hot drinks and frappuccinos just for a slight taste of happiness. Even worse, they had to sweeten their food with finely diced Brussels sprouts or parsnips, hence the famous medieval saying, "Oh my God, William the Conqueror, this cake is disgusting." Sugar, of course, is mined from the earth in lumps, and it wasn't until 1878 that the sugar cube was invented by Lord Baden-Powell, though he intended it as a useful camping tool. The theory is you can float one in water and it would point magnetic north. Rub two together to create a rudimentary torch, or just use them to bribe any scouts you want to keep quiet. And that, my sweets, is all I have for you about sugar, or as the ancient Greeks call it, Aphrodite's crumble.
Thank you, Holly. And at the end of that round, Holly, you've managed to smuggle 3 truths past the rest of the panel, which are that cats can't taste sugar, The second truth is that before the introduction of sugar to Europe, parsnips were used to sweeten food. After crushing the parsnip, the liquid was drawn off, boiled, and used like honey. Parsnip wine has long been made in England, its high sugar levels contributing to a beverage that's similar to sherry. And the third truth is that rubbing two sugar cubes together can create a rudimentary torch. Two sugar lumps rubbed together will create light, or more specifically, triboluminescence. It was first observed in 1620 by Francis Bacon, who wrote, "It is well known that all sugar, whether candied or plain, if it be hard, will sparkle when broken or scraped in the dark." And that means, Holly, you've scored 3 points. The most sugary US children's breakfast cereal is Smacks. Smacks are caramelized puffed wheat grains, which are 53% sugar. So if you want to give your kids a healthy start to the day, an injection of Smack may make more sense. OK, we turn now to Henning Vein, a German comedian. Henning grew up in the wealthiest part of Germany, West Germany. Henning, your subject is Christian saints, persons venerated after their death by the Christian church for having lived lives of heroic virtue or for being martyred for their faith. Off you go, Henning.
Today there are about 15,000 saints, which is roughly the number of Scottish people in Edinburgh.
Zoe.
That sounds about right, that number of saints. I mean, I'm not a big collector of saint knowledge, but if I plucked a figure out of the air, it'd be about 15K.
About 15,000, you pluck 15,000. 15,000. Well, it isn't true, but the number is estimated to be around 10,000.
Not far off.
So you're
that's
not far
sneaky,
off.
Henning.
Yeah, well, it's another, you know, we're not inviting him back. We've discussed this.
They can't all have their own day. That's what I would be worried about.
No, there must be.
You have to share your saint's day with a load of other saints.
Yeah, but
it's just not special, is it? It's like having your birthday on Christmas Day. It's wrong.
Yes. Who do you share your birthday with that's famous?
No one. 3rd of October.
I think you got the format to this show wrong.
Well, 3rd of October is the day of German reunification, so...
There you go.
At least you've
and
got
we
that.
Always celebrate it after we've sung Happy Birthday to me, then we...
Raise a glass to the Brandenburg Gate.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Sent a shiver of terror across all of Europe. Oh, no, it's going to happen again.
Yeah.
Well, it won't be us this time.
Lightning doesn't strike the same place three times. Henning.
So, the rules... This will interest you.
Tony, that's...
It's going to really interest me. It really is.
So if you're really interested by this, you get a point.
Thank you. Okay.
Okay. You've got to be honest.
Great acting there. The rules for being a saint were drawn up by Pope Urban Myth IV.
May not be true, but it's bloody interesting.
Where the poster by his pulpit stating, "You don't have to be mad to achieve sainthood, but it helps."
No, I don't think you can be interested by that, Tony, because it's not true.
This was backed up by the last reliable Italian ruler, Benito Mussolini, who said that the history of saints is mostly the history of insane people. When it's quite easy to be promoted to be a saint and nigh on impossible to get sacked, much like being a teacher or an NHS human resources manager or the chair of Thames Water.
Zoe.
Is it true that once you've been sainted, you can't be unsainted, so you can't get sacked?
Well, not really. You can be sort of permanently benched.
And you lose
your saint's day. Many of the saints revered during the 12th and 13th centuries were removed from the liturgical calendar by the Catholic Church in the 1960s. Up to 93 saints no longer have their own saint's days. They can be worshipped locally, but the Vatican seal of approval has gone. It's the same with me. I can be worshipped locally, but the Pope refuses to endorse it.
Yeah.
The only saints to achieve relegation in living memory... our Southampton FC. The sainted 12 apostles were all tortured. St. James was forced to sit through every Judea town council overview and scrutiny meeting. St. Peter was given a Spurs season ticket. And St. Philip had his head crushed into an X shape and so came to name the popular screwdriver. The only people who don't see dead saints as dead are the heads of the Catholic Church, who celebrate saints' birthdays as the days they died. It was very easy to live like a saint because most of them were around before the invention of DBS checks. There's St. Luger, the patron saint of arms dealers, St. Cyril, the patron saint of sex offenders, and St. Mary Joanna, the patron saint of drug dealers.
Holly. I bet you that one is a patron saint of pharmacists or something like that.
What, St. Mary Joanna?
Even I didn't fall for that one.
Well, even St. Nicholas, or for you and me, Father Christmas, is not just the patron saint of children, but also of prostitutes and pawnbrokers. So if you want a hooker for Christmas, but don't have any money, Santa is a sort of one-stop shop.
So
they multitasked, didn't they? So they'd have had more than one job. So that has gone, Nicholas, you've got kids, hookers and pawnbrokers.
You're absolutely right.
Anyway, you should think twice. You should think twice before sitting in his lap. Deliveroo was predated by St. John the Russian, who was made a saint for the miracle of sending pilau rice to his master, however far away he was. St. Joseph of Cupertino was known as the Flying Friar and was said to levitate and transport other clerics on his back. He drew irritation when he started charging for priority boarding.
Holly.
I reckon there was a flying saint.
You're absolutely right. Yes. It is said that St. Joseph of Cupertino had a tendency to levitate during prayer, becoming known as the Flying Friar. He's said to have first levitated into the air in 1630, often hovering over people during religious ceremonies, including once during an audience with Pope Urban VIII, and even carrying fellow friars on his back during more than 70 flights. It's said he spent much of his time wearing iron chains in an attempt to prevent himself from accidentally levitating. That's a sensible precaution, isn't it? I've got the chains on today, guys. So, you know, I just don't want to be flying off like last week. No, you weren't here last week. Oh, last week you should have seen me. I was buzzing around like a balloon that hasn't been tied up. I think I'll keep the chains on from now on, because if I removed the chains, I would fly.
Interestingly, he was the only saint to be literally canonised.
Tony.
Well, I found it interesting.
Thank you, Henning. And at the end of that round, Henning, you've managed to smuggle three truths past the rest of the panel, which are that Benito Mussolini once said, "The history of saints is mostly the history of insane people." The second truth is that the only people who don't see dead saints as dead are the heads of the Catholic Church who celebrate saints' birthdays as the days when they died, as the Church holds the view that a saint's day of death is the day they were born into heaven. And the third truth is that St. John the Russian was made a saint for the miracle of sending pilau rice to his master, no matter how far away he was. And that means, Henning, you've scored 3 points. As well as being Father Christmas, St. Nicholas is the patron saint of sex workers, despite only coming once a year. Next up is Zoe Lyons. Zoe recently appeared on the television show Celebrity SAS. She did so well that she's now being deployed to Ukraine. Zoe, your subject is spiders, eight-legged predatory arachnids which typically spin webs to capture insects. Off you go, Zoe.
Probably because they can't be asked to do up the laces on four pairs of shoes. 95% of house spiders have never ventured outside. Famously lazy critters.
Tony.
Well, I think house spiders really just stay... I'm losing confidence in this now. They do... Yes, but I'm going to stick with it. They stay inside.
You're absolutely right.
Oh.
Only 5% of house spiders have ever set foot outdoors. In fact, it's thought some house spider species have been living indoors at least since the days of the Roman Empire. It's a common mistake when we find a spider in the house to trap it in a glass and release it outside, assuming that was where it came from. The odds are it wasn't.
So yeah. What happens to it then?
I mean, I tell you what happens when you put a spider outside. Your daughter stops saying, "Oh, my God, there's a spider, but don't hurt it, but there's a spider." So that's the main effect.
A little glimpse into David's private life.
I mean, one slipper and they're dead, but apparently not. Apparently they're horrible, but also must be saved.
Here we go.
The autumn's the worst time. Sorry. Zoe.
Famously lazy critters, you're most likely to spot a British spider shuffling off to bed as early as 7:35 p.m, straight after the nature segment on The One Show.
Henny.
What time do spiders go to bed?
You're not supposed to ask questions.
7:35 seems a reasonable time.
So that's what you're saying is true, Penny?
Yeah, yeah.
You're absolutely right.
How is that true?
According to a study conducted by the University of Gloucestershire, the most likely time to spot a spider in your home is 7:35, which is thought to be the time when male spiders are most active in their search for a mate. The point is, when we say going to bed, it's in the sense looking for a mate to go to bed sexually. Is what is meant.
Yeah,
there.
But if they're doing it in your bed, you're in trouble.
The Cuban bongo spider uses upturned shells as drums. Spiders will tune their webs like guitars, while the bagpipe spider squeezes air out of its abdomen, producing a uniquely shrill sound to attract a mate.
Tony.
I'm trying to lose all my points here. I'm going for the upturned drums.
The Cuban bongo spider.
Yes.
Yes, no, that's not true. Right. Henny.
Do they string their webs like a guitar?
They do.
Oh, I went for the wrong one.
This is, according to a 2014 study, spiders tune the tension of their webs much like a guitarist tunes the strings of a guitar. By plucking the silk strands and listening to the vibrations, spiders gather crucial information about what kind of prey has been caught.
In Suriname, the second most common last name literally translates as Spider-Man.
Tony.
Suriname surname, definitely Spider-Man.
No.
No?
No. The second most is Gompertz.
No.
Rings a bell, Gompertz.
Isn't the guy from the culture show?
That's it, yeah.
Will Spider-Man.
I didn't know he was called. Yeah, there you go. Well, I noticed him walk up a wall in one shot, but...
He gets very horny about 7:35 at night.
Yes.
The Australian Wildlife Trust has gone on a PR drive to improve people's attitude towards its notorious eight-legged inhabitants by giving them cuter-sounding names. On a stroll around the bush today, you may well encounter a sparkle muffin, a tootie bug, or a unicorn clown spider.
Holly.
Oh, go on. Let's have that one. Unicorn.
Unicorn clown spider does not exist.
I do know, though, that they had to take an episode of Peppa Pig out of circulation, which was about not being scared of spiders, because in Australia, that is a really bad lesson to teach people.
No, you're absolutely right. The Peppa Pig episode entitled Mr. Skinny Legs, which suggested spiders are harmless, was banned in Australia.
Can I get a point?
Well, no, because that wasn't the truth. But otherwise, people are going, I tell you one thing, the Battle of Hastings did happen in 1066, so maybe I could have a point.
But funnily enough, not in Hastings, but in battle. Mm.
Yes.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah.
I should know, I lived there.
This show is developing its own fringe. Zoe.
Freckles the spider goat produces spider silk proteins after being implanted with spider DNA. Part goat, part spider, she poses the real dilemma for arachnophobes. How the hell do you suck that up in the Hoover?
Thank you, Zoe. At the end of that round, Zoe, you've managed to smuggle two truths past the rest of the panel, which are that the sparkle muffin is a real species of spider found in Australia. And the second truth is that Freckles the spider goat produces spider silk proteins after being implanted with spider DNA. This is quite horrific. Freckles, known as the spider goat, lives on a farm run by the Utah State University, where she produces spider silk proteins in her milk, which is used to make biosteel, a material known for its strength and use in applications such as bulletproof vests. And that means, Zoe, you've scored 2 points. The harvestman arachnid distracts predators by detaching one of its own legs, which twitches to keep the predator interested while it scuttles away. It's a good trick, but it only works about 6 or 7 times. It's now the turn of Tony Hawks. Tony is currently touring his new comedy and music show, An Evening with Tony Hawks. Tickets available now, £15 to get in and just £30 to get out again. Your subject, Tony, is heavy metal, a subgenre of rock music characterized by highly amplified distortion, extended guitar solos, and loud drumming. Off you go, Tony.
Fans of heavy metal music have more sex than fans of any other music.
Holly.
What time approximately?
7:35, I think.
7:35. Yeah, go on then. They get the most.
They get the most sex?
Yeah.
No. No, they don't. Pop music is the genre most associated with sexual encounters. Conversely, heavy metal and classic rock are at the bottom of the list.
That's why I like free flow jazz. It can go anywhere.
Heavy metal music is often combined with other activities to create irresistible events. In Finland, for example, there's a heavy metal knitting championship, which combines knitting with headbanging to heavy metal.
Zoe.
I know I'm crazy to do this, but that does sound like a Finnish thing, because the Finnish love a bit of heavy metal. I reckon they'll do it to anything.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, Finland hosts the annual Heavy Metal Knitting World Championship, which challenges participants to knit while dancing and headbanging to heavy metal music. Contestants are judged on attitude, originality, artistic impression, and knitting presentation.
Listening to AC/DC whilst operating makes surgeons work faster and more efficiently.
Henny.
I mean, Highway to Hell, and then you cut someone open, yeah.
Well, you're absolutely right. Research conducted by the University of Heidelberg in 2022 found that surgeons listening to heavy metal tracks such as AC/DC's Highway to Hell and TNT actually worked faster, I could believe that, and saw a 5% improvement in the overall accuracy of their surgical procedures. That's where I get skeptical.
In 2021, a brand new heavy metal was discovered at the Cavendish Laboratory. The young scientist who made the discovery called the new element Ozzy Osbornium. The same element had originally been identified in the 1960s when it had been incorrectly classified as a non-metal and named Valdunicum. Animals all love heavy metal, except for these animals. Elephants, who are afraid of it, parrots, except one, who can't hit the high notes, and cats, who can't meow in tune because they find it stressful. The one parrot who can hit the high notes is the lead singer of the death metal band Hatebeak, a 34-year-old parrot called Waldo.
Holly.
I bet there's a heavy metal band with a parrot lead singer.
You're absolutely right. Yes. Yes, an African grey parrot named Waldo is the frontman of death metal band Hatebeak. Waldo's squawks provide the main vocals on their first album, Number of the Beak. Which was released in 2015, as they do on subsequent releases such as Roost in Peace, Bird Seeds of Vengeance, and Beak of Putrefaction.
Heavy metal band Metallica are detested by everyone in all countries. And in Sweden, it's illegal to name your baby Metallica.
Henny.
Well. You wouldn't be able to name your kid Metallica in Germany. I don't know if the same applies for Sweden. But
well, that's not true, but it's nearly true. In 2007, Sweden's National Tax Authority ruled that Michael and Carolina Tomaro couldn't name their baby Metallica. However, they took the matter to court and won, so they were allowed to in the end. Band names in other countries include Nutella in France, RoboCop, Facebook and Scrotum in Mexico, Friday in Italy, Cyanide in Wales, and Tallulah Does the Hula from Hawaii in New Zealand.
Why can't you name them Metallica in Germany then, Henning?
Because if you give a kid a very strange name, it's like seeing they give the kid a disadvantage in life.
But was there a huge list of names then that are considered weird?
Yeah, well, there essentially goes the other way around. There is a list of names that aren't considered
weird.
So
you can only pick from a certain list?
Yeah, but it's a quite extensive list. If you can't find a name in that list, you've got something wrong with you.
I mean, how many different names do we need? 10, yeah. 12,
I mean... In the Kent village of Hambledon, there's a band which combines heavy metal music with cricket statistics. They're called Iron Wicket Maiden. Thank you, sir. In America, there's a heavy metal tribute band that combines the music of Black Sabbath with lyrics about the dangers of unhealthy fast food. They call themselves Mac Sabbath.
Holly. I think it's the heavy metal singing about junk food.
Mac Sabbath.
Mac Sabbath, you're absolutely right. Well done. They describe their music as drive-through metal. Thank you, Tony. At the end of that round, Tony, you've managed to smuggle one truth past the rest of the panel, which is that cats find heavy metal music stressful. And that means, Tony, you've scored 1 point. Which brings us to the final scores. In fourth place, with minus 1 point, we have Tony Hawk. In third place, with plus 1 point, it's Holly Walsh. In second place, with 2 points, is Zoe Lyons. And in first place, with an unassailable 4 points, it's this week's winner, Henning Vane. That's about it for this week. Goodbye.
The Unbelievable Truth was devised by John Naismith and Graham Garden and featured David Mitchell in the chair with panellists Tony Hawkes, Zoe Lyons, Holly Walsh and Henning Vane. The chairman's script was written by Dan Gaster and Colin Swash and the producer was John Naismith. It was a random production for BBC Radio 4.